The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lenox, and Stockbridge. Maybe you're watching us on the PCTV Select app, which is free to download, or watching us on cable channel 1301, Access Pittsfield. Glad you're here with us this morning. It's Friday, August 21st, and we have a special show this morning. We have Pittsfield Police Chief Mark Madalena, first time interviewing him here on the show, and we'll be talking about all kinds of stuff going on in Pittsfield and talking about policing in general and lots of things that people care about. Again, policing is something that connects the community in so many ways, and sometimes it's in the news. As a matter of fact, Chief Madalena is in the news this morning, right on the front page of the Berkshire Eagle. We're certainly going to talk about that and other things here as we move along. First, the weather forecast. We'll do that first from the National Weather Service. Here it goes. Berkshire
weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, patchy fog this morning. Sunny. Highs in the upper 70s. Northeast wind around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy. Lows in the lower 50s. East wind around 5 miles per hour. Saturday, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Highs in the mid 70s. East wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
And longer range, I was hearing that we were going to have some rain tomorrow night, potentially into Sunday, and then potentially also into Monday, clearing up as we move through the week next week. So sounds like today is your best day. Really, really nice day. High in the upper 70s, around 80, and sunny. So we'll take that any day of the week. Sounds like the first part of tomorrow for your Saturday is going to be pretty nice as well. All right. Morning Drive continues here on 89.7 WTBR-FM. And good morning, Chief Madalena. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And I know you're no stranger to the WTBR studio. Back in the day when we were doing, PPD on Patrol, I believe was the program. You were involved with that and with former Chief Wynn as well.
That's right.
I remember the days.
The good old days.
So welcome back to the studio. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been with the department, and how long now have you been the chief?
I started in March. I was appointed, so I was 8, so we're almost 5 months, going on 6 months. But I am 52 years old, born and raised in the city of Pittsfield, PHS grad of 1992, MCLA grad. I've been on the job for 28 years. I started back in the 1900s, in 1998.
The late 1900s, yeah. We'll call it, yes.
Previous century. I started my career. I actually went to school for engineering for a little while, for a couple of years, and then I kind of changed direction into law enforcement once my brother started going through the academy and came on the job, and I decided that's what I wanted to do. So I changed directions in college and went to MCLA and got my degree. And when I got on the job, about a couple of years into it, I realized that I could probably marry my two interests together as far as engineering and law enforcement. And the way to do that was through crash reconstruction, because there's a lot of physics and science involved in that. So in my third year on the job, I was able to get on the in the traffic unit and become crash certified. I did that for 25 years, for 18 in patrol, then I did it as a sergeant, and then I headed up the unit as a lieutenant, and I did that up until last March when I became chief.
Wow. Yeah, I guess, you know, there's so many parts to the police department, and crash is obviously a very big part of it, right? And so what's that like on a day-to-day basis when you've got people calling, you know, immediately. It's not the best day that they've had in a long time. You get there and you have to sort of reconstruct, okay, you weren't there. Mm-hmm. So what happened? And how do you do that? How do you get through that?
Well, it's easier to do it when we arrive and the cars and everything are still there. And we've had instances where sometimes everything gets removed and then we realize or we're called in after the fact when the injuries take a turn for the worst and all of a sudden, you know, you have to go back and reconstruct those types of crashes. Mm-hmm. So obviously if we can get on scene while everything is still there and fairly fresh, you know, and you can kind of read what took place based on the evidence in the roadway and, you know, hopefully you have witnesses that are on scene with you. You know, back in the old days, again, you know, the early 2000s, it was a little more difficult in regards to doing it. There was a lot more science involved. I mean, before anti-lock brakes, you know, we could measure a skid mark of rubber that was left in the roadway, and you could measure the coefficient of friction in the road, and you could actually calculate how fast that car was going at the time that you hit your brakes.
Mm.
You know, with ABS, you don't get those types of skid marks anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, in its infancy, you would get patches of skids. But even those are gone now because the ABS is so advanced that you don't even get those. But what you do have in cars now is the black box, right? I mean, you've had those since 2000s. That was when those started coming out. And we were fortunate enough to be one of the earlier departments to get the software to download that information out of cars.
Hmm.
And it's like what you hear about airplanes when airplanes crash. I mean, every vehicle has a black box, if you want to call it that. It's a data recorder. It's usually in the center console of your vehicle, right dead middle, like center mass kind of thing. So that way, it's pretty much safe for any type of impact or protrusion.
Is that the same plug that the service people will use when they need to diagnose a code? You know, I've got the light coming up on your dashboard saying, you know, whatever, check engine, and they're going to plug in and say, okay, give me the code to see what's wrong. Is that the same computer that you're using to plug in and say, okay, what happened right before this crash?
It can be. Mm-hmm. We can utilize that connection if there's power to the car still.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't get power to the car because it was such a bad wreck that, you know, the engine and the battery or just disconnected completely, then we have to go and actually go into that center console and take that unit out.
Oh, wow.
It's a small black box, not too much bigger than what you got here.
Yeah.
And disconnect that, and then there's other cables that go directly to the module as opposed to the diagnostic module in the car. Once you're able to do that and generate your own power, you can download the information that comes out of that box. And typically what that'll do for most cars, it will record the previous 5 seconds before impact.
Hmm.
Once a car, there's technically no such thing as deceleration, it's a change in acceleration. So once a car changes to a negative acceleration in a microsecond, if you want to call it that, it wakes up your system and it locks in those 5 seconds. And now we can go in there, read those 5 seconds previous to crash. It tells us how fast we're going. Were you on the brakes? What was the input of the steering wheel? Did you have your seatbelt on? Was there any recalls? Excuse me. Was there any malfunctions going on with the car prior to you driving it? As far as, to your point, check engine lights, ABS issues. It gives you all that information. And as technology is improving, you know, with Tesla, for example, I mean, not only are you getting 5 seconds of information, but you're getting 5 seconds of video all the way around that car. So now you're able to see what the driver didn't even see in some instances. So it's coming a long way. So the days of people saying I was doing 30 when they were actually doing 50 are pretty much over. The days of, you know, someone saying that light was green when you can clearly see that it was red are pretty much over.
Yeah. And it's possible that people, you know, because they've been through a traumatic experience, they may not remember it accurately either.
Sure.
I mean, certainly there's some people that are trying to fudge the information, but it also is possible that they don't remember.
They honestly thought the light was green.
Yeah.
How many times I've done it.
Yeah.
How many times, was that right? I could have sworn it was green.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it happens. Everybody's in their own world these days, and we're all busy, and unfortunately sometimes we get a little, life gets chaotic, I guess.
But in that time period that you worked in the in crashes and basically in traffic and the reconstruction and things like that, did you see a change in terms of safety? Where the cars have been getting better, more people have been wearing their seatbelts, you know, more people paying attention to what's going on, airbags, you know, that kind of technology. Have you seen an improvement in outcomes? Because I'm sure there's been some pretty nasty stuff that you end up having to see.
My God. The technology is unbelievable. Mm. I mean, it's the crashes that we've gone to and people have walked away from.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know.
Where 25 years ago, they wouldn't walk away from it or they'd be in much worse shape.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people got to understand, when you watch IndyCar racing or when you watch NASCAR, like, that's the technology that's going in your cars today. So it's aggravating when you bump into a shopping cart and it's $1,000 worth of damage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sucks. I get it. But these cars are made to crumple and they're made to absorb the energy on impact so that you don't absorb that energy. So when you are involved in a significant crash and the car starts to roll or you start bouncing off guardrails, you want your car to be dented as much as possible so that you're not feeling it. Right? If you look back at the old days in the 60s and 70s, the Pontiac GTOs and all that, those were just gigantic pieces of steel.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd run that car into a tree and you wouldn't have a big dent in the car, but you'd have a big dent in your chest because you hit that steering wheel because and all that force came inside that car.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the technology is amazing with these cars, and so much safer than what it was in the past for people. Having said that, that gives people a sense, a false sense of safety in some respects. Because make no mistake, there are speeds that are just not survivable, right? Yeah. I mean, once you get at 60, 70 mile per range, I mean, it's
And you come to an immediate stop.
Yeah.
Because
there's three collisions, right? There's your car hitting whatever it's going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
There's you hitting the steering wheel or whatever you're going to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's your organs hitting your skeletal system at the end of the day. And you get a lot of those severed aortas, lacerated livers, things along those lines, because it's your inner insides striking your bones at the end of the day.
Because you were going a certain speed, and then suddenly you're not, essentially.
Suddenly you're not.
Yeah. So. What about other safety measures that we see Pittsfield and other cities and municipalities starting to do, which is the traffic calming measures? And granted, you know, there's different kinds of driving. You know, when you're on the turnpike and you're going 65, 70 miles an hour, but you have a wide open expanse and you can see everything around you and there's no, you know, intersections, no turning in, everything is predictable. And then there's city driving.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people want to do turnpike driving in the city and that's just not compatible, right? So there's been a big effort to do things like traffic calming measures, speed bumps, narrowing of lanes, and all the things that I talk to Commissioner Morales about when I have him here on the show. Are those things helping to roundabouts? There's another one where, you know, the accidents aren't the speed anymore because you have to slow down to get into the roundabout. Are those things making a difference?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Listen, Ricardo gets flack. We are very lucky to have Ricardo Morales in our city. He does a fantastic job. His intentions and what he wants to do for the city is surrounded by safety.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's looking to do all the time and everything that he does. And, you know, we talk all the time and we work with him in regards to speeding issues throughout the city because we're on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, enforcement is an option, but at the end of the day, it's we can't do it consistently. Mm-hmm. We just don't have the manpower to do it. I mean, the guys are out there answering calls. By the time you set up and get the radar gun out to start doing some radar on William Street, you know, the call comes in because you got to go to Holmes Road or you got to go somewhere else to answer a call. So how do you slow down traffic? How do you change behavior when you can't just dedicate manpower through enforcement?
Right.
I mean, it has to be, don't get me wrong, enforcement has to play a role in it, but it's infrastructure. It's changing the design of the roadways.
Mm-hmm.
It's adding speed bumps. It's putting in roundabouts, to your point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at the roundabout at East and Woodlawn, you know, I know people weren't crazy about it. It's a tight turn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but guess what? I mean, that causes people to slow down to get to that through that roundabout. Before, it was a kind of a, wasn't a straight shot, but obviously you were going westbound, you had to make that kind of a right turn.
Yeah.
People were flying through there. And the crazy thing was there was a crosswalk about 50 yards away from there that if you were in it, you weren't. No, you were a sitting duck.
Yeah, and that was a very chaotic intersection. That was a perfect place for a roundabout, in my estimation, because you had a five-way intersection, and you know, half the time nobody knew who had the right of way to go. Was it this stop sign over here, and where are these people coming from? And this is normal here, and like you said, the crosswalk, a sitting duck. I could just imagine that being a very difficult place to be a pedestrian, and yet, you know, the roundabout comes in, and now traffic is always moving. And that's, I guess, what I like about them is that at least you have this feeling that things are moving, that no one is stopped forever waiting for everything else to happen.
Right.
You know,
100%.
So, but obviously the main thing is that it's safer.
Right.
And that you're not getting those speed crashes. You might still get some crashes. Like, do you still see people having traffic incidents in roundabouts? Is that a problem?
It's almost insignificant. Yeah,
really?
I mean, maybe a couple here and there, maybe some rear enders, people approaching the roundabout and stopping at the yield sign and the person behind them hitting them.
Mm.
I mean, nothing really in the roundabout.
Yeah.
No. Now it's been good. The new construction coming off of at North and Tyler. No, it's been good. I mean, a couple crashes, but they weren't related to the construction. It was just people maybe having a medical episode or whatever it was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I mean, you do these, you make these changes, and then you know, there's always room to improve afterwards. And you know, you see what you have. But yeah, I mean, you know, North Street is another prime example of when we went from two lanes in both directions to one lane in each direction.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, is it a pain because it takes you 8 minutes to get through downtown instead of four? Yeah, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But when you want to look at it from a safety perspective, I mean, our pedestrian crashes on North Street, since we did that, have declined significantly, right? Because you'd have that car in the left lane that was stopped for the person that was crossing the street, and then the car in the right lane didn't realize he was stopping for pedestrian, and it was taking him out.
Right.
And it was happening all the time.
Yeah. And not to mention the fact that having those two lanes on North Street, if someone did feel like the traffic was going too slow, what did you do? You blast right past them, right? And not seeing those people in the crosswalk. So that is probably what made it the most dangerous.
Right.
Bringing it down to one lane, like you said, maybe slows it down a little bit, but that is part of the point.
It's part of the point. I mean, if you want your downtown to be more pedestrian friendly, and if you're looking to bring people to your downtown, well, that's part of it, right? So
change is hard, though. And we assume that there will be another development of the North Street redesign of the of that. I don't know exactly when that's going to happen. We'll have Commissioner Morales on next week to talk about the progress there. And there's been a lot of progress.
There has.
And,
listen, at
and
the end of the day, there's two things people hate. The way things are and change. Right?
But they love the way things always used to be.
Exactly.
In their memory.
So,
Pittsfield Police Chief Mark Madalena is my guest here on the program on Morning Drive, if you're just joining us this morning. We're talking about traffic is what we started on. Let's move on to the gun violence, because we know that's been in the headlines and something that everyone is concerned about this summer. Seems like we've had an uptick in incidents, although the mayor yesterday mentioned that statistically speaking, it may not be the worst time that we've ever seen, but certainly it's on people's minds and in their consciousness right now. What can you tell us about the last 2 months or so since the first shooting that happened in June, and that was over on Tyler Street near the end of Tyler there and First?
Well, I mean, let's talk about reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, to your point, we had a homicide that took place in June that was solved rather quickly. No, we don't have him in custody.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in the area. I don't know where he is, but he will be caught at some point. He'll come across law enforcement.
You're confident that that's the suspect and that's the person that's responsible for that particular shooting?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then that was, I forget, early June. And then the rest of June was good.
Mm-hmm.
July, I mean, would you believe it if I told you we had no gunfire in July?
Hmm.
We had four ShotSpotter activations, five. I just checked this yesterday because I was curious myself. And all of them were confirmed fireworks during July.
Does that confuse the system, the fireworks? Is that a difficult thing to tell the difference between that and a gunshot over ShotSpotter?
It is. Mm. They especially in July, they'll change their system a little bit. They'll change the way the acoustics are receptive, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously we'd be inundated with ShotSpotter calls in July as far as fireworks are concerned. But yeah, I mean, listen, I know there's questions about ShotSpotter and its accuracy and, you know, its benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an advocate for it at the end of the day. I think it's very helpful. I think the fact that it's there and its existence alone is a deterrent, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like it's a tool in your toolbox.
Absolutely.
It's not something that you would completely rely on, but it gives you an idea of what's happening when and where.
Sure it does.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, you know, not everybody calls when they hear a bang. You know, they're not sure what it is.
Mm.
You know, they just don't call.
Mm-hmm.
But ShotSpotter lets us know. I mean, you know, and it's the good thing about ShotSpotter is because of the way the acoustics work, it tells us where, hey, within a It's 50-foot radius.
You can basically triangulate where
where it is. And so you know where to, we're more precisely to look. Whereas if you didn't have ShotSpotter and you just got calls, well, I hear shots, but I'm not sure where it's coming from. We would have no idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're just circling the block trying to find it, figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's helpful, obviously, if there's a, heaven forbid, a victim laying in the sidewalk.
Right.
It gives you, and no one's calling.
Yeah.
It gives you, it tells you, hey, go check this area, and you know, it's there.
So you're so you're looking at that information, but then also relying on calls that come in. So if you know, shots go off and then you start, the calls start coming in, you say, okay, we've got an issue.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
But yeah, July.
So nothing happened in July.
July was a good month, and then you know, you start out August okay, and then it's basically been these last 17 days. Mm-hmm. It's just the uptick has been there for sure, and it's we've had six people that have been injured as a result of gunfire through over these last 6 days. And you know, when it happens like that and it happens in such a short time period, then absolutely, you know, it concern, rightfully so. And people are asking the questions, are we safe?
Right.
And I get it. I mean, you have to ask those questions. My son asked that question Sunday night. Like, I get it.
Yeah. And for folks specifically in the neighborhoods affected, they are probably much more on edge than the rest of us. I'm certainly, you know, if I hear what sounds like a firework outside my window, I kind of think that. Was that fireworks? You know, was that something else? How would I know? Right. But I just know that because, you know, it's in the consciousness right now that we're thinking about it, that it's, you know, more of an issue, and we're more likely to say, is this dangerous? You know, and I think the people in the neighborhoods affected, they're worried about the stray bullet. You know, they're worried about something going through their house, or you know, passerby, a standby, someone, you know, who has nothing to do with it. Suddenly, now you know they're affected.
Absolutely, Matt. Listen, I can sit here and just like I've said before, you know, the vast majority of the population of the city of Pittsfield is safe. You know, everyone who's out there going to work and going home and living their lives are safe, right? If you're involved in the business of selling drugs and if you're involved in, you know, the fact that you go about your business with a gun, illegal firearm on your waistband or in your backpack, and with the intent of using it because somebody disrespected you, yeah, you're not safe. Yeah, okay. But what about, to your point, what about the stray bullet? You know, we're not involved in any of that stuff, but we're still here. We're still part of the community. We may be down the street, just like what took place on another street, and all of a sudden someone gets hit in the hand who's got nothing to do with the argument or whatever's going on. Listen, I love to say and to be able to comfort everybody and say, yeah, we're all safe no matter what. You know, at the end of the day, these people have to take accountability for their own responsibilities, right? And just, what are you doing?
I mean, yeah.
You know, that's the frustrating part for all of us. And you know, for the department, you know, in these 17 days, it's angry, and we all get mad and we're pissed, and the community's upset. But at the end of it, you shake your head and like, what are these people thinking? You know, it's just a lack of disregard for human life, for your own future. I mean, I just, that's the puzzling part for all of us, you know, when you try to figure this stuff out. And I get it. I mean, listen, when we talk about these types of things, and you know, when you talk about the people involved in these types of activities, I mean, it's a cycle, right? I mean, if you're talking about poverty, drugs, and violence, and you know, it's not,
and
like
the
influx
of guns, I would imagine too. It's more availability. Higher availability, does that figure into it?
Sure. That's, unfortunately, they're very easy to come by if you want to get one.
Yeah. What are some things that people can do to help with the problem? Because, you know, policing this can only do so much, right? There's a reactiveness to it you know, but there's some proactivity that maybe people, ordinary people, can do. Activism, some outreach. What are some of the things that you would recommend that people do so that they don't feel powerless about it, that they don't feel like they're just sitting ducks, as we said?
Well, I mean, when it comes to preventative type stuff, I mean, it's hard. We can't get in anybody's mind to see what's going to happen. I mean, lots of the times these things stem from arguments that take place in the heat of the moment. But if you're a neighbor, if you're watching something take place outside your window and there's a heated argument going on, and most people will call, you know, but if you're considering, you know, if you don't want to get involved or what have you, I mean, I would ask that you call. Call at that point, right? Let's try to get our guys there before it gets to the point where somebody does pull out a gun. And then we have to respond after the fact. You know, and it's not, I know and understand the fact that people find it difficult to cooperate with the police, certainly, you know, in those certain sections.
Mm-hmm. Has that been difficult for these investigations? I know you can't talk too much about the ongoing investigations because we don't want to damage that and hurt the possibility that someone who, you know, may end up becoming picked up and go through the process, you know, actually gets convicted. You don't want to endanger that. But at the same time, you know, what was going on with that right now with regards to people being able to say, hey, I saw something, I want to tell you that. Are people afraid to do that right now?
Sure. I think there's a fear of retaliation. Mm. I think it's just the rule of the streets also, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, we have a really good relationship with our community. You know, I think the approval within the community as far as our police department is overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean people are going to come out and get involved, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because there's always that fear. But having said that, you know, we have tip 411. People can go on and provide anonymous tips that way. They can obviously call our tip line and do it that way. You know, people have been very helpful in regards to just providing video footage if they have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those are the things that we ask for. If you don't want to get involved, if you're afraid to be a part of the investigation as far as identifying yourself, and you want to do it anonymously, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all very helpful in our investigations.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, if you're in the area and something happens and you see us there, and take a look at your ring camera, take a look at mm-hmm. whatever video surveillance you may have. You may have caused something, maybe mm-hmm. before the fact, maybe after the fact, but you know, you never know what you may have on there that may break the case at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's another new technological innovation in the last, 5 or 10 years or so, where the sort of proliferation of ring cameras and security cameras that people have on their own premises that are aimed out sometimes at their from the front door, or from the garage or whatever. You may not have thought that you were going to capture something that happens, but then it happens right there.
Right.
And how much does that play into sort of the forensics of putting this all back together and figuring out what happened?
If we're fortunate enough to get video, I mean, it's significant because it puts a video and it puts pictures together for your timeline,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it puts pictures together you know, with your reports and with your witnesses, and it corroborates, you know, what is being said. So it's, you know, if and when you get to a jury portion of the investigation, I mean, it provides them with a visual of what took place, right? So it's a lot of the questions that come about are eliminated mm-hmm. because you're watching it.
And longer range, what kinds of things would help you and your police force to be able to fend off some of the problems that are causing these, because there are causes to this. Like when you see the shooting, that's the sort of the end result of something that's happened, right? The stuff that happened before that was the drug trafficking or the guns infiltrating or the domestic violence or the whatever that causes that. What kinds of things would you like to see? What kind of support would you like to see to prevent some of that stuff from happening?
I'm going to be honest, we have a lot of support. We you know, our community, our city does a lot of good stuff. You know, as far as when we talk about like mental health, for example,
mm-hmm.
and drug addiction as well, you know, we have resources out there, whether it's DMH, the Breen Center, Second Street, mm-hmm. Second Chances through the Sheriff's Department, the HUB program, which I didn't know much about when I first became chief, but I've kind of dove into. And I mean, Captain Lindsay Cornwall from the Sheriff's Department, she's in charge of that, and she does a great job. And basically what it is it's recognizing people in the community, talking with them,
mm-hmm.
ensuring that they have the resources in place to help them. If they don't, trying to get those resources in place for them, and you know, and trying to help them. The first that was opened up on First Street has been a godsend for us. It really has. It's been a fantastic place for our unhoused to go and
how does that help on your end? So that's something that's not going to be potentially funneling people into creating more crime and more problems. You're basically helping them before something like that festers.
For sure. I mean, mm-hmm. as far as the resource aspect of it, yeah, if we can provide them with the resources they need and put them on the right path, yeah,
mm-hmm.
then they're not going down the life of crime. They're going down hopefully a life of you know, support.
Yeah.
The first, you know, we would walk, myself and one of the co-responders, Tony Melillo, we would walk North Street all the time when I was on 4 to 12, And you know, we would just talk to the unhoused and, is there anything we can do for you today? You know, we'd have pamphlets with us with all the phone numbers, and it'd be the same people we'd run into every night.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it would just, it was the outreach just to talk to them, say, hey, listen, if tomorrow is a day that you decide that this isn't life you want to live, we'd love to help you walk through those doors over there to get you some help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very few ever took you up on the offer. I mean, it's, I always tell the story of some of the girls that I spoke to who I knew were you know, involved in prostitution and obviously using drugs. And I would always ask the question, like, this can't be where you thought or where you wanted your life to be. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, we're offering you assistance. We want you to better. Why do you decline? Why is this? And the response would be, I know what I'm doing. I understand what the consequences are.
Mm.
I'm okay with how my life is right now.
And
I also think a lot of it had to do, to be honest with you, especially when you're talking about heroin, that fear of, and that's just anxiety of the sickness that comes along with withdrawal, I think is a big part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a program that the mayor has put money towards, I don't know if he talked about it yesterday or not, the opioid.
No, we didn't talk about that yesterday.
So there was grant money that he was able to get through the state, opioid funds, and he's able to use it for a lot of things. And one of the things that the city did was they connected with the Breen Center, and there is a shot that if people want to go to the Breen Center, you can get it, and it helps. So if you're a heroin addict, for example, and if you go and you get the shot, I wish she was here. It just helps with withdrawals.
Yeah.
And it can help you, obviously, you don't get that sickness like you would if you're just trying to withdraw.
And the fear of that withdrawal is the thing that's driving
folks
to continue that because you don't want to be in the other position.
Right.
So
the problem is, the good thing about that, just real quick, is, and when I'm talking about the money behind it, was the fact that typically those shots would cost money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't even know if insurance would cover it. But because the opioid money was put towards that, those shots are free.
Hmm.
So it's a benefit if we can get the people to the Breen Center to, you know, to want to do that. But
a lot of moving parts and no simple answer to a lot of this stuff. So that's why we like to dig a little bit deeper and talk about those things. Chief Mark Maddalena is my guest here this morning, Chief of Police here in the Pittsfield, in the city of Pittsfield. Let's do that top of the hour break, Chief, right now, and we'll come back and talk more about what it takes to recruit new officers onto the force. And I know we want to talk about e-bikes. So lots of stuff to do. Let's do that right in just a few moments. This is Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM. Pittsfield Community Radio will return right after this.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield. 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu.
And from Sandrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Massachusetts. Retractable awnings, retractable screen, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms. Customized solutions available online at sandrini.com.
Will you be an angel for our WTBR DJs? Every day our DJs are cold, hungry, sad, and lonely, and they are crying out for help. For only 30 cents per day, WTBR can provide them with clean studios, microphones, audio board, and much, much more. Go to WTBRFM.com and click the donate button and become a friend of WTBR. For only $8.97 per month, you can put some smiles on these faces. WTBR for the love of radio.
Hi, I'm Leslie Hertzberg, Executive Director of the Berkshire County Historical Society. Spring through fall, we look forward to welcoming you for tours of Herman Melville's historic home, Arrowhead. We offer a wide variety of in-person and virtual programs throughout the year. Visit BerkshireHistory.org for information on programs and to schedule a tour.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Hey, this is Mike Pezzo. Remember those tunes your parents told you to turn down? Better yet, remember those tunes your grandparents told your parents to turn down? While on Mike's Amazing Music and Oldies show, you'll hear sometimes oldies, sometimes blues, sometimes local performers, and a lot of rock on Berkshire County's only rock station, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, Thursdays at noon. Tune in and be entertained and educated.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP is hiring an Assistive Technology Regional Center Program Manager to lead a dynamic program that helps individuals with disabilities gain greater independence and access to their communities. Apply today at ucpwma.org.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you this morning, Friday, August 21st, and we have Pittsfield Police Chief Mark Maddalena on the program talking about issues in the city and around Berkshire County. Before we get back to that, I just want to mention that Pittsfield Community TV is turning 40 this year, and we're inviting you to join the celebration. PCTV's 40th anniversary celebration is on September 18th at Berkshire Hills Country Club starting at 6 p.m. You can enjoy an evening of food, fun, and dancing. The tickets are $50. The event will also feature a keynote address from WTEN's Ryan Peterson. So you can go to pittsfieldtv.org for more information on that and to purchase tickets. That's PCTV's 40th anniversary celebration on September 18th at Berkshire Hills Country Club, beginning at 6 p.m. We hope to see you there. You only turn 40 once, and I remember it well. but PCTV is turning 40, and we've been serving the community that long. And obviously, PCTV is running a WTBR-FM, which is why you're listening to this program now. We do a few cool things here, so we'd like you to come out and celebrate with us. All right, let's do the weather forecast and then get back to our conversation with Chief Maddalena. Here we go.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, patchy fog this morning. Sunny. Highs in the upper 70s. Northeast wind around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy. Lows in the lower 50s. East wind around 5 miles per hour. Saturday, partly sunny in the morning, then becoming mostly cloudy. Highs in the mid 70s. East wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, nice day out there today, so enjoy it while you can. It's a nice summer day. We don't have too many of those left, I'm sure. So enjoy it while you can. Nice blue skies. I'm looking out the window right now, as a matter of fact. Welcome back to Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR-FM. And Pittsfield Police Chief Mark Maddalena joins us again on the second half. Thanks again, Chief, for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So we got a lot in on the first half of the show. Let's talk about what it takes to recruit new officers to the force, because it seems like if you watch city council meetings at all, and every once in a while you'll have a group of new officers coming in and being sworn in as officers. Let's rewind that a little bit and talk about what it takes to get to that point and how difficult it can be to keep a fully staffed police force. Right now, you're not probably up to full staff, I'm guessing?
Nope, not yet.
How many officers do you need to make that full staff?
We were at 89, and then we had six come on, so it was 95. Mm-hmm. Then we had two, we lost three, so it's 92. We're right around 91, 92.
Mm-hmm. And you lose them through retirements,
yes,
and injuries, I would imagine, things like that?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So it's always difficult to sort of keep that level. And the level of manpower, obviously, is important to be able to handle the kinds of things that we talked about in the first half of the show. All the calls that you get, if you get three or four big incidents where that requires some investigations, you have a detective bureau, obviously, right, as well?
Correct.
So how is it that you're managing that with having fewer staff than you would like to have?
It's difficult, especially in the summertime, because police departments are not any different than any other business. Mm-hmm. People like to take vacations. Mm-hmm. So you deal with that on top of it. So, you already have your manpower issues, and you deal with that on top of it. We have guys who are, God bless them, One of our officers, Jake Doyle, just had his son, Joseph. Congratulations.
Oh, congratulations. You know,
so there's FMLA that goes along with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's hard,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're not fully staffed to begin with. But I tell everybody, you could give me 97 officers, and we're still not going to be able to do everything that we want to do mm-hmm. at this point. Policing has changed. Our department has changed. Technology has changed. What we need to do has changed. So 97 people back in, again, the late 1900s, early 2000s, is different than what 97 people are doing now, right? We have different departments. We have different positions that we have created over time because of the fact that policing has changed and we've needed to create those positions.
Mm-hmm.
So those positions come out of patrol. So, you know, at the end of the day, that's patrol suffers. You know, when you look at the city of Pittsfield, that's 44,000 people. It obviously balloons in the day, during the daytime as far as, you know, BMC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what the number is, but I assume we jump over 50,000, mm-hmm. probably closer to 60,000, mm-hmm. you know, with all the people that come in here and work during the daytime. You know, right now we're at around 30,000 calls for service, you know, in August.
So 30,000 calls per year?
No, that's to date. So
30,000 calls year to date?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, for the entire year, I mean, got to be somewhere around 50.
And is that a normal number? Is that higher or lower than typical?
It's a normal number.
Normal, yeah.
We're a little bit lower now mm-hmm. than we have been, but mm-hmm. typically we're right around in the ballpark of where we've been.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the calls range from all kinds of different stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Not just the stuff we talked about, traffic
right.
incidents and, you know, shootings and things like that, but domestic violence and you name
Barking
it.
Barking dog
right?
to homicide, for sure.
What is it?
Barking dog to homicide.
Yeah.
It runs the gamut.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Yeah.
So.
So tell us what it takes to recruit new officers and what their path is. How, when they start and they say, okay, I'm interested in becoming a police officer, what do they have to do?
Right. So times have changed, obviously. If you want to become a police officer, you can go on to our website or you can go on to the state, Mass State website, mm-hmm. Civil Service, and it updates you with when the test is going to be. Mm-hmm. There's two different pathways to...
And this is a civil service test?
Civil service test.
Okay.
So now we're fortunate enough within the last year, Lieutenant John Maggio, he's fantastic. He's one of our recruiters slash detective lieutenant slash hiring guru slash the guy does everything. But he was able to kind of get us involved in this alternative pathways for hiring as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you can take the civil service test, which is typically in April, and it's done every single year. Or when we open it, you can take a separate test that's for the city alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called, like I said, the alternative pathways test. Basically, on either test, you have to pass the test.
Mm-hmm.
Once you pass the test, you go on a list. And then from there, we go through that list. Depending on how many people we're going to hire, let's say we're going to hire five,
mm-hmm.
then we will interview or go through at least three people per position, so that's 15.
What kind of qualifications and things that you're looking for when you look at that list? You're looking for education, or you're looking for interests? What kinds of things do you look for?
So to be a police officer, you need a high school diploma or equivalent. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's what you need.
Okay.
Just to pass test, do that, and then, like I said, that gets you on the list. And then, you know, once we start doing our background investigations on those officers
mm-hmm.
or prospective officers, you know, that we can differentiate from that point in regards mm-hmm. to maybe some other qualifications.
So there's some disqualifications as well, right? Some things in people's past that will disqualify you from moving forward.
Yeah, if you have a criminal record, and, mm-hmm. you know, nothing, not everything,
yeah.
right? I mean, you can have an OUI, you can have certain things, but mm-hmm. if you have a pretty significant criminal history, we're not going to select you,
yeah.
obviously. You know, once you get through that process, you have to go through the physical portion of it. You have to pass. There's a PT and a PAT, which is kind of confusing.
Mm-hmm.
The PT test is consists of a mile and a half run, a 300-yard sprint, push-ups, and I forget what it's called. One more thing. Mm-hmm. It used to be sit-ups, but it's different now. Whatever. but you need to
know. Physical test, for sure.
Physical test.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And you pass all that, and then, you know, you'd be offered an employment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's difficult. Like I said, back when I was trying to get on the job back in 1998, we had to go to a high school. I don't remember if it was in Springfield or Worcester. I don't remember where it was. But there was got to be 2,000 or 3,000 of us all applying for the same job. If you mm-hmm. didn't get a 98 or higher back then, you weren't even considered. Mm-hmm. You may as well fail the test.
Wow.
If you pass the test now, mm-hmm. you're probably going to get an interview.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of people that want to do this job, that apply for it, has shrunk.
Mm.
No, just unbelievably.
So if you're offered the job, that's really just the beginning of your path, right? Because then you attend the police academy.
Then you go to the police academy. That's between five and six months of training. Mm-hmm. You get out of the police academy once you successfully graduate.
And how many do? What's a general percentage of people that make it through the police academy?
Now, it's probably close to 90%.
Okay.
Back in the day, it was probably closer to 60 or 70.
Wow.
They did more kind of washing out back then.
Mm-hmm.
The academy is also not what it used to be. It's not the screaming and yelling and the, you know, the military kind of mm-hmm. stuff that it was before.
That sounds like it's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because basically you're imprinting on, you know, young recruits sort of a more violent path in a way, right? You're going to translate that onto to your
yeah.
job.
When you're talking de-escalation and the way we handle things nowadays versus, you know, the way things were probably handled back in the 80s, I mean, yeah, it's a different type of style of police
mm-hmm.
that you need to be taught in the academy. You know, it's not the us against them mentality. It's mm-hmm. it's a community kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you had to change the training.
Yeah.
But once they come out of the academy, they do 14 weeks of FTO, and what that means is you'll be partnered up with different officers, training officers, and you ride around for 14 weeks, and they basically grade you and you know, make sure that you're learning the job and know what you're doing. And then your final 2 weeks is called shadow phase, which is basically, you know, you have one of those FTOs, but he's in plain clothes. He's just there to observe, and he watches or she watches you do your thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you successfully complete that, then you're on your own. So, you know, if you look at it, that's the problem with police.
So that's when you become the sworn officer. That's the final step.
Well, that's the final step before you're on your own.
Before you're sworn once you graduate
with the academy.
Okay.
So
gotcha.
But yeah, that's when you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the complicated thing about police that people don't understand. It's like, you know, from the time you take the test to the time that you're out there on by yourself, it could be anywhere from a year to 2 years,
mm-hmm.
depending on where you are on that list. And that's difficult for us. You know, if you're a corporation, you're looking to hire, you can hire somebody and they can start next week. If we're looking to hire and you need a job, we're not going to get to you mm-hmm. until God knows when. And by the time we do get to you, you may have found something else.
Right.
So there's a lot of barriers for it.
And then I assume there's ongoing training also for police officers. It's not a static occupation anymore, right? It's not that you learn it once and then you just sort of carry that through your career. There's all kinds of new things that are coming through.
We're required by state to do 40 hours of training. I'll say that includes firearms, but also includes a lot of other stuff. The MPTC basically dictates, you know, what we have to train as far as 24 hours of training, and then the other 16 hours is the firearms.
Mm-hmm.
So they change it up every year in regards to what those 24 hours are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
We go above and beyond that in Pittsfield because, you know, in addition to what the state requires, we carry certain things on our belt like tasers and bowler wraps and mm-hmm. less lethal weapons. That's not required by the state, but we carry them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's additional training that goes on top of it. And when you look at policing across the country, I mean, Massachusetts does a really good job as far as training goes. If you're an officer in Massachusetts, you want to transfer to somewhere else in the country, they will eat you up
mm-hmm.
when they know you're from here.
Yeah. Pittsfield Police Chief Mark Madalena, my guest here this morning on Morning Drive. If you're just tuning in and, talking about what it takes to become a police officer these days in Pittsfield and also in the state of Massachusetts. Been a lot of talk about how police respond to mental health calls. Certainly that's been in the news with the Hinsdale incident in January and in previous incidents in Pittsfield. How do you see that evolution going where you know, if you get a particular call and it's a specifically someone in a mental health crisis, could be a firearm involved. Maybe there's some other dangerous element to it. But maybe the first responder shouldn't be a police officer. Maybe it should be someone who can help the person with the mental health crisis. How do you feel about that?
I disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you talk to our co-responders, they would disagree with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
your co-responders are police officers?
No.
No.
No, they're civilians.
Okay. All right.
But they should not be going to calls without us.
Okay.
Without us seeing, making sure that the scene is safe and, mm-hmm. and that they're safe.
Yep.
Listen, I'd be the first to admit, you know, Chief Mike Wynn implemented the co-responder program. It's got to be close to 10 years, probably not that long, but let's just say 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when he was talking about it, and I was a patrolman at the time, I'm like, this is crazy. I don't want to sit there and babysit a psychiatrist while they're trying. And I'll tell you today, I mean, it didn't take long for me to recognize the value of that and see mm-hmm. that that's one of the best things that department has done
because mm-hmm.
they're fantastic and they do a great job for us. But our job is to keep them safe. And what people don't understand when it comes to clinicians and what that job is when you go see your therapist or when you go see a psychiatrist, you're making that appointment to go and you know, mm-hmm. spill whatever issues it is that you have.
Yeah.
These clinicians aren't showing up to appointments. They're mm-hmm. showing up to people in the midst of a crisis mm-hmm. at that time. They're mm-hmm. living, you know, they're having their worst day
yeah.
in that moment, and they need to come and you know, de-escalate that and talk them through that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a completely different dynamic than what a typical clinician would have to deal with. And they do a fantastic job with mm-hmm. it. But no, you don't send them into a fire. Mm-hmm. You know, and they wouldn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. So how many co-responders do we have for the city?
Right now, three.
Three. Yep. And is that enough for the number of calls that you get for those kinds of things?
I think
we could use more
yeah. for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, we with the three that we have, Tony Melillo, he works a split shift. So he works a 2 4-to-12s, then he does 2 days. Ariel Ramirez, she does the 4-to-12 shift. And then Claudia Stewart, she does the day shift. So there's the way that the schedules, they work a 4-on-2-off schedule. So if they're not taking time off, there's coverage all the time. There's no coverage after midnight. That's where the Breen Center helps us out, because mm-hmm. the Breen Center also has a co-respondent program for other towns within the community. Mm-hmm. So you know, if we don't have a clinician that's on, we can contact the Breen Center and see if they have somebody available.
So it sounds like it's an evolving area of police work where basically, you know, you're sort of coming to the terms that different skill sets are needed in different situations.
Absolutely. Listen, at the end of the day, not everyone's comfortable with talking to somebody who's in uniform, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes they put up a wall when they see that mm-hmm. uniform for whatever reason, past right. experiences, what have you.
Right.
You know, I can share an experience where I walked into an incident when I had Richard Collins was with me at the time, one of our co-responders, and the individual had a knife to himself, and it was a suicidal suspect. And mm-hmm. you know, we walked in that room, kept our distance. I said, listen, you know, obviously you're having a bad day. I can see that. You know, you may not want to talk to me, but if you put the knife down, I got somebody who'd love to talk to you out here. He's a clinician. He has much more experience than I do in this, and you know, he'd love to have the opportunity and just that alone, you know, de-escalate the situation, put him at ease. Yeah, I'd like to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And of course, Richard came in and did what he did, which is, you know, he was fantastic.
So it's really decisions in split seconds that absolutely. Can make a difference between a good outcome in that moment and a right. bad outcome.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you never put a clinician in jeopardy. I mean, mm-hmm. we're not going to introduce them into a scene until we know that it's safe for everybody.
Gotcha.
And that's what people have a hard time understanding. It's like, well, you know, in certain situations, well, why didn't you send a clinician in there first? No, we're not. That's mm-hmm. that's irresponsible mm-hmm. to do it that way. You know, you send the officer in first, like I said, to secure that area, make sure it's safe first, and then bring them in. Mm-hmm. Now, they're there to support and help us, not to do our job
right.
at the end of the day.
Pittsfield Police Chief Mark Maddalena, guest here this morning, and a few minutes left in the show. We definitely have to talk about e-bikes. And again, something that's going on right now and certainly in the news, a couple of incidents in the last week where we had folks that, I guess e-bike versus vehicle versus car. How difficult is it right now knowing that there are lots of these e-bikes, a lot more than there used to be, and very few, if any, regulations regarding licensing the bike or training the drivers or anything like that? How much of a problem is this in Pittsfield?
It's a problem. It's not just for Pittsfield. It's a problem throughout the state of Massachusetts. It's a problem throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Some states are doing a little bit more proactive than our state, to be honest with you, as far as legislating these bikes and the way that they're doing it. No, right now we have a Tier 1 and a Tier 2 e-bike as far as classifications go. A Tier 1 e-bike is you know, a pedal assist that gets you around 20 miles per hour. Tier 2 is something that's just where you can just have throttle mm-hmm. and you don't need pedal assist.
But it still has pedals?
Still has pedals.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, that's a good point. Let's make sure we have a distinction between what's an e-bike versus what's an e-motorcycle.
Right.
E-bikes have pedals. E-motos have pegs, like a regular motorcycle. Mm. And make no mistake, e-motorcycles are illegal. They should not be on the street at all. They go under the classification of recreational vehicles, and they cannot be on the road. So
that's the Tier 2 or the Tier 3? That's where I get confused.
The motorcycles?
Yeah.
That's nothing. That's just an e-motor. That's a separate category of itself. The e-bikes, as far as the tiers, are based on speed and throttle assist versus just pedal assist.
And what's the top speed that the e-bikes can go? And again, those don't need to be licensed, right? There's one tier of them that has to be. You have to have a tag and have to be licensed for it, have to pass a test.
Once they eclipse that 40-mile-per-hour mark, mm-hmm. over 30, again, this is where it's gray.
Yeah.
This is where it's gray
here. That's what makes it confusing, I think, for people, because they don't know, and it's such a new thing,
right,
for a lot of people. You know, they know what a bike is, but now you look around and you're like, okay, that person's not pedaling at all, and they're going almost as fast as my car.
Right.
And by the way, they're coming at me in the wrong lane, so now how do I deal with that as a driver?
Right.
I think that's where a lot of the anxiety comes from.
It does. And like I said, it's difficult for us. I mean, you look at a state like Washington, they've done some recent legislation in regards to e-bikes, and they made it pretty clear. Anything over a 750-watt motor,
mm-hmm.
is going to require a license, registration, insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it still hard to look at that e-bike and say, is that a 750-watt motor? Yeah, I mean, for sure. But we also know that a 750-watt motor is only going to produce so much speed. So if you're going 40 miles an hour, it's safe to say that's not a 750-watt motor, right?
Yeah.
750 watts is going to get you around 20, 25 miles per hour. I mean, a typical bicycle can get you that fast,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, with the legislation that's being introduced now with Governor Healey, she's looking at different tiers. You know, where we have classes now, class one, class two, she's looking at tier zero. Tier zero would be basically a 750-watt motor that can get you from 0 to 20.
Mm-hmm.
A tier one would be 20 to 30. A tier two is 30 to 40, and then it goes up from there.
How about age limits for being able to drive these? Because right now, anyone, 10, 11 years old, I mean...
Yeah, they're bikes.
There's nothing stopping any of them, right? So, and where's the training, right?
Where's the training?
There's nothing required.
There isn't.
Right?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You have to make a clear line in regards to what's going to be considered a bike and what's going to be considered a motorized scooter, right?
Yeah.
And then once you make that determination, now it's registration, insurance, and license. And I say make it 750 watts. Mm-hmm. Anything below that, you're fine. Anything above that, it's going to require all that stuff, right? Because at the end of the day, these people are driving on the roads, and they're hitting our cars, and they don't have any insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So we're paying the deductible. We're getting screwed at the end of the day.
Almost seems like, though, that if there was more training and experience where kids or adults who are driving, either way, know the rules of the road, right? The rules of the road are there, so it's predictable for everybody. You're going to have fewer incidents, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have fewer problems, fewer accidents.
Sure.
And it's the times when they do sort of something that's unpredictable and that's against the rules of the road where you have the problem.
Right. Listen, at the end of the day, I mean, it's our responsibility as parents. If we're going to purchase these bikes for our kids, then it falls on us to make sure that they understand the right way and the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
to operate those bikes.
And we all know from being kids that sometimes that bike, you get on that bike and it's freedom from people telling you what to do, right? And you get out there and you make mistakes. And
you
I remember anyone who was a kid who was on a bike probably remembers making a mistake. The problem is the mistakes, I think, have a bigger consequence now.
Well, they do. Yeah. I mean, they certainly do if they're riding a bike that's over 750 watts and it's going 35, 40 miles per hour. Because like we talked about with car crashes, this is a different thing.
Yeah. Right?
There is nothing surrounding you. It's you hitting the surface.
Yeah.
So as a parent, if you're going to make that purchase for your child, I mean, look into it, research it, understand what you're getting, understand the power that these bikes have. Understand the fact that there's a difference between getting a 750-watt motor but it's going to tell you that, hey, this is also capable of over 1,000 watts, right? Because sometimes you can just go on the display and you can change the display to increase the power. So you have to see, like, how is it being advertised versus what it's real? Because, yeah, you may think that you're getting your child that 750-watt bike, but your kid knows, okay, that's great, but I'm just going to change the setting and on the display here, and it's going to go up. It's going to increase the wattage on that. So, I mean, you have to look at that and know what they're getting.
It's a brave new world here and a lot to think about, and the regulations don't always keep up with the new technology and the new things that are happening. Chief Mark Maddalena, I want to thank you for being here this morning. Time went by really fast, and glad to have you give us that information this morning. Always good to talk to you, and we'll have you back again as things move along.
It is. Listen, I appreciate your time. Just one more quick thing.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot going on, you know, negatively in Pittsfield as far as the violence and the shootings go on. Again, it's a short time frame, but that's not what defines our city. It's a safe city. The people in the city are fantastic. You know, our community is fantastic. There's a lot of good things that go on in the city, and unfortunately, it's overshadowed by stuff like this because this is what gets the front page at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But don't ever lose sight of the fact that of what we have here in the Berkshires and in Pittsfield.
Great note to end on. Appreciate that. And a good note to start the weekend, everybody. So have a great weekend, and we'll be back with Morning Drive again on Monday. Take care.